The past day and a half together has provided much to reflect upon and digest. In terms of the primary theme for our gathering, the appeal of American evangelicalism, we have explored its historical roots, the arguments for the utilization of some approaches of the evangelical movement in our church, and I think we also, especially today, identified those points of tension between modern-day evangelicalism and that distinctively Lutheran identity to which I referred in my introductory comments yesterday. It remains the task of our final presenter to, in some sense, draw together what has been said, but especially to address that important question of where we go from here, the future of evangelicalism and Lutheranism in North America. Few can carry out thy assignment better, especially from a churchly perspective, than Dr. Thomas Zinder, president of our Florida, Georgia district of the LCMS. President Zinder is a 1961 graduate of our seminary and is currently writing his thesis for the Doctor of Ministry degree program at Columbia Theological Seminary. His pastoral service to the church has included 9 years as a missionary to the Japan Lutheran Church and 18 years in Georgia and Florida parishes, during which time he served on a variety of committees at the district and synodical levels, including chair of the LCMS World Relief Committee. President Zinder has authored numerous Bible studies, sermons, and articles on Lutheran education. He has been serving as a district president since 1988. His district is uniquely comprised, I would suspect, of traditional Lutherans and those whose experience in the church has been flavored by somewhat of a Southern evangelical culture as well. It is a privilege to have him here with us, President Tom Zinder.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. I'm going to attempt to bring up my program here in just a minute. I'm using a computer simply because I did not have the opportunity to write anything out on paper. I just had a little note here that said error, so I wonder what that means. We'll be with you in just a minute here. So have you enjoyed this symposium? See, I'm kind of new to Word Perfect, and I'm not sure exactly how it all works. Actually, I turned it off, and I'll turn it on in a minute again. Dr. Johnson was up here before I got here, and he was fooling around with this machine. I have an idea. While I'm waiting for this machine to come back to life, I would like to say that I was a little bit concerned about my dress today. I really felt the need to go over to the bookstore and see if I couldn't find some sort of a clerical shirt to wear. But unfortunately, the only kind of a clerical shirt they had over there was a short, sleeved clerical shirt, and that's not a part of my style. So I decided not to get one of those. So instead, I bought these. I'll show them to you anyway. And when I go home, I'm going to jog around the block, and people will ask me, what is exactly my relationship to the cemetery? And then I'll tell them. I got it. All right. Quo vadimus? Doctors Boltz and others who have planned this symposium actually had decided to entitle this presentation, Vohin. But in deference to evangelical and church growth penchants for good communication, thought better to use a more communicative type language, therefore the quote, vademus. Quod vademus, where are we going? Well, I'll tell you, folks. I'm going home. And in order to expedite that, I'm going to make these comments rather brief. But on the other hand, this may be the last time I'll ever be invited to speak in these sacred halls. When Dr. Volz called and asked me to participate as a reactor to all that we've heard and seen here, my first impression was that, well, he's made a mistake, and he rang me up instead of Martin Marty and then was too embarrassed to admit his misdial. You know, it's kind of like looking up John Johnson in the phone book, and you find so many, so you just call the first one, and it's the wrong one, but there's nothing you can do about it. At any rate, Jim said that we were looking for someone from the field to sit in on the symposium, listen to the presentations, the questions, the answers, the discussions, and then try to address all of that as if you were back in your home territory and you were telling someone about the event and how it struck you, and I suppose I can do that. As I have anticipated this event over the past weeks, I've clipped a few articles, read a couple of books, whatever seemed to have something to say about evangelicalism in general. And here's something I came across, rather interesting, from a rather new publication called Religion News, the April 1992 edition. The headline of this article is Evangelical Leaders Lining Up Voters and Agenda. Now, in the article, we are told that leaders of the National Association for Evangelicals have their political agenda ready for this election year. The NAE leaders are expecting George Bush to show up at the association's convention in Chicago next month as a standard bearer of God's law. They want him to weigh in against homosexual rights, radical feminism, and federal funding of the arts. In this election year, marked by few signs so far of involvement by high-profile evangelicals, Mr. Dugan's challenge to Bush is one sign that the religious right is still in the political arena. Quote, "We are praying that the president will come down on the side of the moral law of God on these issues," unquote, said Dugan in a speech to evangelicals in Minneapolis. The association's goal is to enroll 1 million new evangelical voters. A voting drive will be organized through 47 affiliated Christian denominations. Dugan said in a telephone interview that Bush had been told what he should stand for if he wants evangelical support. He said religious activists had been distressed recently to learn that as they were meeting with Bush's top campaign officials, other Bush campaign organizers were meeting with gay rights activists. The evangelicals on the political scene have much influence, it would seem. You'll be interested to know that indeed President Bush did go to Chicago, did speak to the 50th annual convention of the National Evangelical Association. I'm sure many of you too, but I received a note from one Lee Ann Metzger, deputy assistant to the president for public liaison, which says, quote, "Yesterday, the president traveled to Chicago to address the 50th annual convention of the National Association of Evangelicals. In a speech that was warmly received by over 1,000 pastors, denominational leaders, and lay people, the president stressed common shared beliefs, including family values, a strong defense, voluntary prayer in public schools, religious freedom, and the sanctity of life. The president thanked them for helping advance the values we share. He said, quote, "Evangelicals point our country toward the future, and with the diligence and hard work and confidence that only a firm faith can provide. In so many crucial ways, your concerns, he said, are the concerns of your countrymen. Our government was founded on faith. Government must never promote a religion, of course, but it is duty-bound to promote religious liberty. And it must never put the believer at a disadvantage because of his belief. Applause. That is the challenge that our administration has undertaken. To be succinct, it is my conviction that children have a right to voluntary prayer in the public schools. Applause. Another article that caught my eye about evangelicals recently was one entitled, "The Vanishing Organist." This, too, is the fault of the evangelicals, at least by one way of reasoning. Quote, "With the ascendance of pop-influenced Christian music has come the decline of the church organist and church music. The inclination toward contemporary Christian music is most pronounced in the evangelical denominations, with demographic studies showing that those churches also are the ones young people are most often going to. In time, there will be fewer and fewer people exposed to the organ and its appeal," the article said. Shame on you evangelicals for even taking away our Cassavants, our Holtkamps, and Schlickers. These are just two references which speak to us of the influence and presence of the evangelicals in a workaday world of politicians and church musicians. Who are these people, these evangelicals? In Germany, they've even coined a new word for them, not evangelische, but evangelica. Thank God that at least in Germany they won't be confused with the evangelische or Lutherans. And it just goes to show again that you have to be German to really get it right. We didn't come from Germany for nothing, did we? Well, back to the original query, where are we going in all this? Now, I would not begin to say I know exactly where we're going to end up after the dust has settled in a few years or decades, but I'd like to share a few observations about some of the things we've heard and discussed here. Dr. Nathan Hatch was very helpful in his straightforward presentation of the history of the movement. As an evangelical himself, I admired his integrity in pointing out not only the strengths of the phenomenon, but also the weaknesses. But I thought the strengths were particularly fascinating. I believe they were the following. Number one, strong in communicating the faith to others, particularly to the common people. And this in contrast to European orthodoxy. Number two, pretense is exposed and openness and vulnerability are fostered. Smugness, hypocrisy, snobbery, railed against as those attributes reared their head in an earlier society, even as they do today, at least in some circles, and perhaps to some degree in the church. Three, strong in the field of education and literature. Evidence of that are with us today in several publishing companies that trace their origin to evangelical sources. And four, innovative, a strong ability to be adaptive and not stuck on the Wir bleiben beim Alten's way of thinking, which may be associated with an evangelische Kirche dear to the hearts of many here. When Dr. Hatch was speaking about these strengths, I, and at least some of you, and this was obvious from at least one questioner's remarks, probably thought, my goodness, that sounds like Lutherans at their best. It reminds one of the exuberance which seemed to be a part of Luther's experience and period, strong in communicating the faith, exposure of pretense on the part of higher-ups, strong in education, literature. Luther's papers may not have been so well known if it had not been for Gutenberg, but on the other hand, Gutenberg may have had nothing to print if it had not been for Luther. Innovative. Do it in new ways. Bring in music. Have the people sing the truths of God's word using the music, pardon me, from the streets. O Haupt voll Blut und Wunden, an example of at least one. And O Welt, ich muss dich lassen, another. For originally, that was a tune about leaving Innsbruck. Innsbruck, I now must leave you. So the poet sang. When she began, the questioner related the strengths of evangelicals with all the good things Luther had done and asked, when did we lose all this? I don't think we got a definitive answer to that query. Maybe we don't know. Maybe we didn't lose those strengths at all, or maybe they are just a bit too well hidden these days. I appreciated very much the beautiful presentation by Dr. Preuss, who is able to articulate so very well the perceived difference in ecclesiology which exists between the evangelicals and the Lutherans. And by the way, I complimented Dr. Preuss Sr. on his younger son, and he said, well, he takes after his mother, and I think we would all agree with that. It was good to hear from Dr. Preuss succinctly. Evangelicals, based on law and America. Lutherans, gospel, church Catholic. The evangelicals, seeking their context in relation to America and American culture. Lutherans seeking their context in relation to the church Catholic. Evangelical ecclesiology is sociologically driven. Lutheran ecclesiology is driven by a sense for and understanding of the Una Sancta. As I was listening to Dr. Preuss, I couldn't help ask myself the question as to why it felt so good to hear what he was saying. Well, for me, it felt good because it was affirming and reassuring to hear once again that what we believe, teach, and confess is true and scriptural. I would venture to say that the warm applause, well deserved, which was given to that address, partially at least, came from people here who were absolutely relieved to be reassured that Lutherans are not so crazy and off track after all. Thank God I am on the right team, sort of feeling. And oh, my arm hurts from this unusual position of patting my own back. Now that's an okay reaction to affirmation as long as it does not close down our ability to look carefully at other ways of thinking about and meeting the challenge of reaching and teaching and preaching the good news to those who so desperately need to be reached and to be taught through the evangelical preaching of the word. Mark Ellingson, a Lutheran, in his book, The Evangelical Movement, does a great service in attempting to understand the evangelical movement, its tenets and beliefs in the best and most constructive light. I appreciated his approach and would recommend it also to you. There are others too, not Lutherans like Dr. Preuss and Dr. Bartelt and Dr. Lukey and us, who speak powerfully affirming words to Lutherans. I was given an article by Mark Knoll for reading and reflection. He speaks so complimentarily about the Lutheran understanding of the church, of word and sacrament. He encourages Lutherans to speak to America and evangelicals about the church in such a way that American Christians might find a spiritual truth to Luther's claim that outside the Christian church there is no truth, no Christ, no salvation. Lutherans can help evangelicals understand that the church, unlike other institutions, is not a production of human creativity, but rather the creation of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Knoll asks Lutherans to speak to others about what he calls the Augustinian conception of human nature. He comments, in America, it was simply too much to believe that sinfulness, the curvature of the self in upon the self, was a greater problem than sins, the freely chosen actions of the will. As a result, American Christians have largely lost the Reformers' belief in the labyrinthine depths of human self-deception. And so they have lost the ability to feel, as Luther felt, the thrilling victory of God's grace in Christ. Knoll also challenges the Lutherans to speak to America about the objectivity of salvation, justification by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. Tell them, he says, that God saves in baptism, that God gives himself in the supper, that God announces his word through the sermon, that God is the best interpreter of his written word. Lutheran convictions all but lost in the face of American confidence in human capacity. And finally, he instructs Lutherans to offer Americans the voice of Luther and his theology of the cross, summarized in these words: "I believe that Jesus Christ, true God, begotten of the Father from eternity, and also true man, born of the Virgin Mary, is my Lord. At great cost, he has saved and redeemed me, a lost and condemned person, delivered me from sin, death, and the power of the devil, not with silver or gold, but with his holy and precious blood and with his innocent suffering and death, that I may be his own, live under him in his kingdom, and serve him in everlasting innocence, righteousness, and blessedness, even as he lives and reigns eternally. This is most certainly true." So Noel, too, affirms the Lutheran theology and understanding of the gospel as something that must be heard, proclaimed, and believed. His affirmation is appreciated, to be sure, and I have more than a hunch that we are in sync with what Noel and Preuss and Lucke and others have said about the tremendous heritage which is ours as heirs of the Reformation. The theology that we have received with its heart and soul in justification by grace through faith in Jesus Christ cannot be improved upon. It is everything that is needed by people who are searching for meaning and an end to chaos in their lives. Well, since that is the case, then why this hankering, as the sometimes irascible John Pless writes in a recent forum, after an evangelicalism that has fallen prey to neo-Baalism, a term ascribed to some evangelical camp followers by Eugene Patterson? Under the spell of neo-Baalism, American pastors have been transformed, quote, into a company of shopkeepers, and the shops they keep are the churches, preoccupied with shopkeepers' concerns, how to keep the customers happy, how to lure the customers away from the competitors down the street, how to package the goods so that the customers will lay out more money. You've got a need, we've got a creed attitude. I think basically that we are drawn to that movement, if we are drawn, because many of the churches called evangelical seem to be more successful than we in reaching people. Some of their churches are growing at phenomenal rates, while many, if not most of ours, are not. We sit back and wonder, what is it that they are doing to get all those people? It probably isn't Lutheran, otherwise they wouldn't be growing like that. And usually this line of questioning and probing on our part will lead us to do something to change what we might quickly perceive to be in the way of such growth. That is, our worship habits, liturgy, garbs, customs, because we're convinced that that's the place where the problem is, at least some may be. But I wonder about that. I wonder about that because in my part of the world, as I go about visiting churches so often these days as a guest preacher, I have become an outsider looking in. And I can tell you why many Lutheran churches don't grow. Not all, of course, but some. I think most of it revolves around the type of leadership the pastor gives. Good pastoral leadership will not always result in numerical growth when the demographics forbid that type of growth, but given normal demographics in parts of the country where there are reachable people, churches will generally grow through good pastoral leadership. And that's the kind of church growth that we can wholeheartedly involve ourselves in. An example: Holy Cross Lutheran Church, Riverdale, Georgia. Ron Jansen is the pastor. Red hair, not healthy, lives on one kidney, diabetic, always something going wrong with his lousy body. But what pastoral leadership! Really genuinely loves the people, is not pushy, not authoritarian. When he wears his clerical garb, it is an indication of his caring priestly role to people, not and never a sign of authority or hierarchical stuff. He prepares himself well for the pulpit, although he's not a flashy preacher. Uses the old Lutheran hymnal with warmth and care, only because they haven't had time yet to order the new one. Too busy with other things, perhaps. Pokes gentle fun at the homogeneous principle each day, and especially on the Lord's Day, when the church is packed with 40% Laotians, 10% Cambodians, 50% Anglos, and all three languages used at each service. Another example might be Holy Cross Lutheran Church in North Miami, where 38 birth countries are represented in the membership of the school and 19 nationalities in the congregation. Where most congregations in that section of Miami are waning, closing down, moving out, Holy Cross is growing, renovated their church building recently, taking in dozens of people almost every 3 months. Church growth indeed. The secret? It has to be in pastoral leadership, exuberance, trust, loving people, and an attitude of servanthood. If we as pastors do not feel so talented and blessed to give this kind of leadership which may result in growth, then we need to hone our skills, learn all we can from all sorts and conditions of people. Yes, from sociologists too, and from church growth type people as well. Taking what is good and that which finds harmony with our center as Lutherans, justification by grace through faith, and pitching the rest. It seems to me that someone who is focused and centered on the faith properly should be able to do that without doing damage to that one thing needful. Good music? Well, what's good music? Are chorales good? Contemporary music, is that good? The German chorales are good. They're very good, all of them. All to be adapted to the worship of the Lord, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. As one here pointed out to me in a private conversation, first-year student at your seminary, as Dr. Preuss said, the church is Catholic, universal, thus should be able to embrace all into herself, sanctify it, and make it acceptable. Dave Banke, the Atlantic District President, tells the story of one man in his former parish in the Big Apple, sort of a roughneck fellow, hood type, converted to the faith. Banke, sensitive to trying to do whatever he can do to get people into his former parish, was trying to be sensitive to the needs. He instructed the organist to trash the old version of A Mighty Fortress, you know, the one that goes da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, that one, in favor of the even-noted style we got from Bach, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, thinking that this would be easier for these new people who weren't acquainted with the Lutheran way. But the organist was an old stubborn German from Nebraska, and she demurred. So Banke got his roughneck off the street, this new Lutheran in, and had both versions played for him and said to him, "Which one do you like?" "Hey man, I dig the one with the beat. It's cool, like reggae. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da." And so Luther's version won the day and its way with the people of the city. Don't tell me that chorales are out of place. Little children sing and love them. Non-German Americans love them too, and people in the Orient love them. Some years ago, a Japanese artist who is known there for his ability to play the ancient bamboo flute called the shakuhachi, and whose fame for that talent in the Orient is commensurate with Horowitz and the piano in the Western world, was introduced for the first time to the ancient Easter hymn, Christ lag in totus bonden. This man of stature wept over the beauty of that melody. "It haunts me," he said. "Explain the text to me, please. What could have inspired this melody?" I think we have much to learn from the evangelicals. I do not agree with those who classify all that they do as irrelevant and off the wall. Much of what they do, their methods in reaching people, They're savvy about good mic systems, adequate parking lots, 80% filled and you need more space, contemporary music with integrity, easy to follow formats also for the uninitiated, a valid concern for those who want to reach people and tell them about justification by grace through faith. Those are things that indeed touch on common sense and perhaps are also valid First Article concerns. An approach such as, what can we learn from the evangelicals, not what's wrong with them, would be just as helpful for us and our beloved Lutheran Church. I would like to close with words from Knowles' article again. After proposing that America needs to hear Luther speak again, and that Americans need the words that Lutherans have been speaking to each other all these generations, he concludes, quote, "These are words, indeed, that Americans need to hear." Remember, those words were about the church. Those words were about the Augustinian conception of the sinful nature of the human race, the theology of the cross. These are words that Americans need to hear. They need to hear them in church, but they also need to hear them in the universities, in the boardrooms of corporations, in the halls of Congress, in the military, in homes and schools, in athletic fields and shopping malls and the factory floor, in every place where the restless hearts of men and women search for meaning, forgiveness, truth, and the hope of life. They are words that can be said in other ways by other folks, and they are not the only words people need to hear. But reservations, qualifications, and limitations do not make them any less important. They are also words that Lutherans have long repeated to themselves and to their children. Americans, to be sure, do not stand by with bated breath to see if Lutherans still believe these words or if they can find a way to speak them with power in the late 20th century. Whether Lutherans still believe these words or whether they can speak them with power today are, however, questions that no outsider can hope to answer. They are questions that Lutherans must answer for themselves. Let's listen to anyone who can help us do a more credible job of this blessed task. Certainly listen to our own theologians and teachers, and I would suggest even to some of the evangelicals. Thank you. I have a message up here. It says, save document, yes or no. I don't know what to do. I think I'll save it.
I'm going to let President Zinder, if you would consent, to respond to any questions or comments that you want to make, coming to the microphones for a few moments.
I know it's hard to ask questions when such a definitive statement has been given. But should you have anything yet you need cleared up, feel free to ask. Thank you.